This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've got about a quarter of an hour now for questions and comments. So I'll throw it over to you. There are two or three things that sort of occur to me, but there's a question right at the back on the left.
Hello, Peter Bush from the University of Northampton. Thanks so much indeed for those three very stimulating sessions. Brown, in one sense, disappointed me, but I thought I was going to be disappointed. The good thing about it, I think, was the paragraph about part-time, and like Tricia, I heard the hear-hears or whatever it was in the House of Commons behind John Denham, so let's hope that that comes to pass. My question to our colleagues is, one particular sentence in Brown really annoyed me about part-time, which was rather like Deering, the assumption that part-time students were in work and therefore receive money. What are the speaker's views on the apparent ignoring of Brown, of the opportunity for students to access loans for living as against loans for teaching?
Well, I'll go through that one. And at the same time, the point came up in Rob's presentation about sort of how many people would get support anyway at that 33% level. I wondered, Claire, do you know what the answer to that one is, even roughly?
What I can say is what we know at 25%. I had done some modelling on if 25%. And the reason why, interestingly, we'd selected 25% of full-time courses, of course, is because that represents 30 credits. And there is an issue that 33% equals 40 credits. Mm-hmm. And for a large proportion of higher educational institutions, their courses are designed around 15 credits and 30 credits. So there was a logic to my original thinking. That's not to say that how universities package their courses in terms of credits can't be changed, but given that at the moment the majority of courses are 15 or 30 credits, it made sense to model 25%. And what the modelling showed is basically you would, at a minimum, double the proportion of students who were potentially eligible. But my modelling work, and this is my, you know, my modelling work also looked at if you changed different income thresholds. But certainly you'd double the proportion of students who would potentially qualify for loans. The issue is, of course, of those people who qualify, what proportion of them will take advantage of the loans? And at the moment, we really can't say. What we can say is from research I have conducted that loans are likely to be, and this is slightly counterintuitive, loans are likely to be most attractive to younger students and actually to poorer students.
And on the question from the floor.
Well, indeed, at the moment there looks as if there are no loans for living. We do know, I mean, nationally, approximately 81% of all part-time undergraduates are in paid employment. So those who are not in paid employment are indeed the minority. Whether, of course, that'll change with growing unemployment. But you're absolutely right, there's no provision at the moment for loans for living, and students who currently, that 10% of students who currently get a course grant will lose that. However, and this is the however, there are two other things. There's this access and retention fund, and there's also, what's it called, the scholarship fund?
Student Scholarship Fund.
And at the moment, it's not clear who will be eligible for that. But I suppose I would guess, that that may become some sort of hardship fund, as we used to know it, and that those students in financial hardship may be able to get some money towards the costs of their course costs. But at the moment, we just don't have enough information about how that money is going to be distributed. in those two funds.
Is it an issue, Rob, that you think Brown's missed a trick?
Well, I think he's missed a trick. Yeah, he's missed an opportunity to widen participation at a time when access might well be jeopardised, and I think at a time when quite a lot of the potential students might otherwise be unemployed for the next 2 or 3 years. So I think there's possibly quite a cheap opportunity there to do it. I think if it were to be done, I guess it won't be, but if it were to be done, then I think I'd want to see some safeguards against the disreputable end of the private and for-profit market. And I'm not talking really about the institutions currently operating in UKHE. I'm talking about the ones who might come in, who have brought higher education in the US into disrepute to a certain extent by exploiting the grants and the loans available to poor people to do courses in higher education, and transferring the risk to the government. And that was a point I made when I was speaking. And I think there need to be some safeguards against, as it were, disreputable recruitment if those additional incentives were there. But yes, I'd like to see it, Peter, but whether we do is very doubtful, I guess.
Is it an issue at Birkbeck, Tricia, do you have a higher proportion in work, perhaps?
We certainly have a higher proportion of our students are in work, but being in work in London doesn't mean you're rich, because you can be earning quite a lot and still be struggling in London. I think it did disappoint us when we read that grant, that there were no grants for part-time students, that the only grants were for full-time students, and they were only around living costs, not learning costs. Two things, I think. Birkbeck and the OU have joined up a lot on lobbying activity, and the conversation between the two heads of institution last week was because we're not there yet. We're at that point when Brown is published and we don't know what is actually going to happen. So what other things we may attempt to influence now, and it is exactly that, supporting the poorest, because I think that is the thing we feel is not quite right, but we believe there's opportunity to influence. The other conversation we're having at Birkbeck is about philanthropy and the role of philanthropy in the support of poorer students. Because at Birkbeck, we actually managed to raise quite a lot of money for student support through our former students and friends of Birkbeck. At the moment, we use that as a top-up, because students at the moment who come to study at Birkbeck, if they get the full government grant, it doesn't pay what it costs to study an undergraduate each year at Birkbeck. And we use that money to top up the difference. And it's what can we do with that philanthropy, and what are the messages around philanthropy that will actually bring in money to support our students, which has been the tradition for many years. So for us, there's that sort of what can we do ourselves with money that we will earn through fees and money that will come in from donors to support those students.
Any more questions? There's one come in from one of our online viewers, John Morrison from the University of Aberdeen, asking sort of primarily Claire, on the question of financial support for part-time students. One of the factors discouraging part-time study is that while full-time students get full relief from council tax, part-time students get no such relief. Has this been discussed anywhere, and is there any suggestion that this will change? I don't know if anyone...
Indeed, when I say it's been discussed, who knows? I wrote a paper and submitted it to Brown, and I wrote it with David Malcolm from the NUS. And what we did is we looked at two fictional characters. One was studying part-time and one was studying full-time. And we looked at what Social Security benefits they received. And the first finding was very important. The first finding was, I think we had 7 or 8 different definitions of part-time student, depending on whether you were talking about about HESA, HEFGE, council tax, other different social security benefits. So there is no standard. I mean, the first thing is there's no standard definition of what a part-time student is, depending on whether we're talking about HESA data or funding from HEFGE, or whether we're talking about social security benefits, council tax, and what have you. So we are very aware of the different treatment of full-time and part-time students, and indeed we have informed Brown about that. Where it goes, I cannot say after that. But the answer is that yes, a very unequal treatment of part-time and full-time students in terms of access to social security benefits, including housing benefit, and council tax.
I don't know if either of you want to come in on that. No, fine. Anyone else want to come in at this point? I mean, the thing that I sort of raised in the introduction was the question of whether universities and colleges would see the opportunity to put the fees up a lot when support for students suggests that they'd be able to bear the cost, even though not all students part-time will get the support. I wonder what our panellists think is likely to happen in terms of fees, whether there is going to be a big rise in the aftermath of Brown, assuming that it's implemented. Rob, what do you think?
I think the key thing that Brown did that not everyone was expecting was effectively to take the cap off at a very high level, you know, for fees. Because I think there had been lots of discussion beforehand about would it be 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000, and I don't think that many people even late on were expecting 12,000 or more. So the question is whether the genie is now out of the bottle and can people be put back. If it could be put back, then I think even at a £7,000 fee level, most of the sector might nominally go for that and then start discounting and so on. So we might, as it were, replicate the current regime but at a higher fee level, thereby perhaps achieving some of the reductions in government spending that are being looked for. As soon as it goes beyond 7, and maybe even if it goes beyond 6, then we're into completely different territory. And I guess that was precisely what Brown was trying to do. He was trying to introduce that market. What will institutions do? It's extraordinarily hard to know. And I think, as Tricia was saying, until we see the white paper, we're not really in a position to even start to choose between the various scenarios that everyone is modelling. I would say if there's a cap at higher than 7,000, we're into a very wide variation of fees. We're into the possibility that some institutions will go private because they don't like the levy and so on. So we're into a very different situation. The mass of the sector, I guess, will settle somewhere between 6 and 7, which is what Brown says.
But surely not for part-timers, will they?
Well, I mean, the question for part-time is whether you can actually, as it were, charge pro rata. I mean, my institution 10 years ago tried to, in effect, swept away distinctions between part-time and full-time and tried to charge by module, by credit, in effect, the same price for all students, regardless of mode. And of course, what you rapidly find is that in some areas, like MBAs, you can charge a great premium, and in most areas, the market will not bear that. And so you really have to do heavy... we ended up, in effect, heavily discounting in a lot of areas just to make sure that we would have some part-time students. Mm-hmm. So...
I mean, we only have part-time students, so do we have to put our fees up? Yes, absolutely we have to put up our fees, because if we don't, you know, our courses don't become viable, and our student experiences, well, I mean, I think actually what would happen is the courses would close. So I think there is no choice. I think for us, and I think this is the conversation most institutions are having, is where do you position yourself on that quality-price continuum? You know, what is your position in the marketplace? What will students pay? And I think in the full-time sector, there is a proxy for that now, which is about grades. You know, the institutions that I think will be charging the highest fees are the institutions that select, and the institutions that will be charging less are probably the institutions that are in the business of recruitment. So I think that is a very complex decision-making process now. And until the point at which everybody goes public and you know what your competitors are charging, I think it's a really difficult thing to do. I'm interested in whether we end up as we did in 2006. They thought there would be a marketplace, and actually everyone just set their fees at exactly the same point. And I'm interested in whether that's about to happen and everyone sets it at 7,000. But are we considering a pro rata of 6 or 7? Yes, we are, because I think if we don't, as an institution that only has part-time students, where does that leave us financially? I think there's another dimension to this, and I heard... the economist at LSE, Clegg, what's he called?
Nick Barr.
Nick Barr, because I'm, you know, someone who's very used to working with part-time students, you worry about debt. You worry about the student's fear of debt, and will this have an impact on students coming to study? Nick Barr did this fantastic presentation, which I actually found, in the end, quite persuasive, that said it's about changing the student's perception of debt. You know, if only 10% of our students at the moment get government support, that means 90% of them are paying their own fees. This new structure, if we can explain it and describe it in ways that take away the fear of debt, It's about having, you know, taking that risk at the beginning that says, I will take out the loan, because at some point, if I don't earn enough money, I won't repay it. And if I don't earn very much money, I'll be repaying it at a discounted rate. So it's worth the investment in a future that may earn me more money. And I think it's all about sort of risk-taking of students. And I think we have a challenge of that pre-entry information that gives the student as much information about the risk level that encourages them and enables them to take that loan if that's what they want to do. So I think it is a challenge for us.
I think what will happen at Birkbeck will happen nationally, given the withdrawal of the T funding, the funding for teaching. But what we also have to recognise is that while Bob's institution may have been charging a pro rata rate of their full-time fees, that's atypical nationally. So nationally, the vast majority of part-time providers have, to date, not been charging a pro rata rate. They've been charging less than a pro rata rate. So what we will see and is that the rate of increase in part-time fees actually may be, on a pro rata basis, go up at a faster rate than for full-time fees, because if the T grant is taken away, if the teaching grant is taken away, then suddenly there is no money, and there may be less opportunities for cross subsidy. But I agree with Trish that it's terribly important to educate students that this is not credit card debt that we're asking them to take out, that this is income contingent. And I think, Bob, as far as we know at the moment, part-time students, even though they may be earning above that £21,000 at the time of studying, as far as we know at the moment, there's no evidence to say that they will have to start paying it back until they either finish, complete, or withdraw from their studies. And that's when they'll have to start repaying their loans. But that may change, but that's as far as I understand.
Just coming back, I mean, there would be no sense, obviously, in charging less than the most you can afford, the most you think the market will bear for anything that is above that 33% threshold. But I just think that raises an interesting question, because we may well end up quoting two prices to students. You know, if you want to come and do 40, my institution has 4 times 30 credits, typical undergraduate sort of structure for a full-time program. I predict a rash of 15 credit modules almost immediately, more than we have, just because it will push, 45 credits is just enough. And it raises the possibility that if you want to do this module in this package, which pushes you over the 33%, then the price is this much. And if you just want to do 30 credits, then the price is this much. And that's an interesting sort of dilemma for institutions to tackle, I guess.
We're over time here, but there are two or three questions. If we could be quick with them, one here and one over there.
Okay, Nicola Jackson from North Hertfordshire College. Two questions, actually. Is there any evidence about ethnic differences in attitudes to debt? Because we're picking up some cultural questions now among our part-time students who are horrified at the thought of taking on debt for the first time, because currently part-timers haven't been accruing debt. And then secondly, is there any firm evidence about the graduate premium? Because figures are still flying around about the enhancement of earnings, and as HE expands, I'm not sure we can trust them.
And then one at the front lady.
And Jameson Birkbeck, another Birkbeck person. I just wondered if the panel had, obviously different perspectives, Tricia being very optimistic, on the question of the ELQ. Personally, I can't see that they would be eligible for student support, since they have never been, as far as I know, been eligible for student support. What happened with the ELQ was the institutional support. So it seems to me quite a challenge there, still, possibly, unless you've got another thing.
Okay, Claire, I think that's your territory.
Research I have done for the government, the student income and expenditure studies, which looks at nationally students' income expenditure and debt. We did find that there were differences by ethnicity, and we did find that those differences were statistically significant. Particularly, students from Asian backgrounds were less likely to take on student loans than those from other minority ethnic groups. However, the most recent 2007-2008 study, while finding differences in take-up, these are not statistically significant. So I don't know what's happened, but it may be that, one can guess that, you know, as there was the point at which I did that study, what we found is that students were taking out loans for living costs, but at that point in time, there weren't loans for tuition fees. So there, you can, I mean, you know, students, and we know that from all the research, that students have a way of trying to minimise their debt. They can live at home, they can engage in term time employment, they can try and go to cheaper universities or university nearer their home. Once we're talking about loans for tuition fees, it's much more problematic to not take them out. So I think that's probably why there's been a change. And so I think over time that some of those differences by ethnicity will disappear. In terms of the graduate premium, there will always be different. Different studies showing different returns to an undergraduate qualification, and that will vary depending on levels of supply and also levels of graduate unemployment. So there's no fixed. It'll change over time, and we'll have to. You know, we've only just got the first set of graduates who are graduating, entering the labour market, who have paid the £3,000. So, you know, it's still too early days. You know, there's a delayed before we can get the information. ELQ, Anne, I think you're probably right. It is unlikely that they'll be eligible. ELQ students will be eligible for the new student funding package, but who knows?
Do you want to come in?
I just want to pick up on ELQ because I think it fascinates me that lots of politicians said, "Oh, actually, we think we got ELQ wrong." You know, there's been lots of discussion that said actually it was a mistake and it didn't raise that much money. And it interests me now whether this is a backdoor way of getting rid of ELQ, because it doesn't mean that much anymore. I mean, I don't think they're ever going to get the living package, but the learning package is just about loans. And if we lobbied hard that ELQ students were coming back to reskill and upskill in a different economy, and the government is very interested in reskilling and upskilling, and the risk is quite low because all they're giving them are loans, and these people are probably in employment and they'll be able to pay them back at the higher rate, I'm not so sure that we won't get loans for ELQ students, and I think that would benefit us. We've been charging ELQ fees now for the last few years, and we still have significant numbers of ELQ students coming to study with us. At degree level, it hasn't had that much impact. At sort of certificate and pre-entry level, it has. But I am really interested in that one paragraph in Brown to see how it plays out. I mean, it may well be that we lose it all, but it may be that this is their moment when they say, actually, we got it wrong.
Rob?
I can't say anything about ethnic attitudes. It just makes me think that in terms of student attitudes to the university, there is quite a lot of evidence, mostly American evidence, which says that students who pay more have higher expectations in terms of their grades. And it's contingent on discipline. So business studies students are most likely to say, I've paid, I want a 2-1 or at least. And arts and humanities students are least likely to say that. That's what the American evidence suggests. And those differences are quite significant, so that could be interesting too. In terms of the graduate premium, Brown, as far as I can read it, and every time I read it, I have a different view, he says two or three different things about the graduate premium and doesn't seem to come down on choosing one or the other, because it ranges from 100,000 to 200 and something thousand over a working lifetime. And at one point, Brown says there is a 400% return on investment for this student, you know, in higher education, without any evidence at all that I can see, although I perhaps didn't track through the footnotes carefully enough. I just don't know where that came from. What I would say is that I think in terms of widening access, underrepresented groups are most likely to be deterred by low living costs, and that's going to go for part-time and full-time. You can translate that into economic terms and say they discount the future at a higher rate than almost anybody else because they're looking at, shall I go to college and get 3,750 or whatever the amount is, or shall I get a job for 15 or thousand or 12,000 or whatever, and that looks like 3 years of 15,000 rather than 3 years of 4,000, and for all sorts of good reasons, underrepresented groups are going to be deterred by those things. So although Nick Barr is always very persuasive, and I agree, Tricia, absolutely, and in a fundamental way he's right, it doesn't necessarily deal with the difficulty that we have in terms of recruitment.
Good, thank you very much. Well, we've gone over a bit, but I wanted you to have your chance to ask a few questions. I think the ELQ will be an interesting debate. David Willetts was genuinely very critical of it at the time, and I'm sure would like to do something about it if given the opportunity. And even John Denham didn't want to do it, but had his arm twisted by the Treasury, who will probably still be twisting David Willetts's arm. So we shall see. But thank you for all our panellists for an extremely stimulating first session.